evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. 2 years ago, the Human Rights Commission of Malaysia, SUHAKAM, commissioned an in-depth study on statelessness in Peninsular Malaysia. The resulting 350-page report was recently released, and joining me on the show today to discuss the key findings and policy recommendations is Dr. Melati Nungsari, who is the lead author of the report. She also wears many hats, including the faculty director of the ASEAN Research Centre, associate professor of economics at the Asia School of Business, and research affiliate at the MIT Sloan School of Management. We also have joining us on the show Wong Yu Lee, who is here to help us better understand the intersectional lived experiences of a stateless person. Welcome both of you to the show, Melati and Yu Lee. If I may begin with you, Melati, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the report, why SUHAKAM commissioned it, and what you had hoped to achieve through your research.
Yeah, so thank you so much for that question. So SUHAKAM really wanted to look at statelessness actually from sort of a human perspective. So for those of you listening in, you may know that there's a lot of legal scholarship surrounding this because there's a lot of constitutional law stuff going on. There's a lot of case law related to statelessness, but there have not been, up till this report, one, an attempt to sort of put everything together, and then two, trying to put together the experiences of actually being stateless. So Yu Lee, for example, and a lot of his colleagues basically, you know, were able to tell us, how does it feel to be stateless in Malaysia? How does it feel to basically essentially be Malaysian but not have, you know, proof of citizenship and stuff like that? So SUHAKAM really wanted the human aspect a bit more than the legal part, which is why they came to a social scientist instead of a lawyer.
Okay, all right. And wonderful that you could join us today and share a bit about your journey. So tell us, you know, your journey and what you have experienced. So what is your current status and how did you get here?
Mm-hmm. First of all, I would like to thank you for having me today.
Sure.
So this is my first time on the show.
Oh, we're glad to have you back.
So I consider myself as a stateless Malaysian.
Okay.
Maybe another term, I would say formally stateless. Why I say I'm stateless Malaysian? Because the problem has been solved for me only. But the issue of statelessness doesn't being solved at the policy level, as a national level. So I would like to say I'm stateless Malaysian. So why I'm stateless? I'm actually a victim of gender discriminatory citizenship law. So my mother was Filipino. My mother is Filipino. My father is Malaysian. So they didn't have any legal marriage status. So that leaves me stateless.
Mm.
So I've been in the struggle of citizenship for the past 22 years. So my journey actually ended last year, but it actually doesn't end right there.
Okay. What do you mean by that? So it ended when you received your IC, your identification card. You received your IC, but it didn't end there. So can you explain?
Didn't end there as in you have been lost so many chances when you are stateless.
Right.
10 years, 20 years, you have many things you need to do to maybe get back what you have missed. Like you have to get driving license, you have to do many, many things to really actually go back into, I would say on track, to go back on track. So the journey, statelessness journey, doesn't really end when I receive my IC, I get a copy of my IC, it doesn't really end there.
Okay.
So I believe.
So may I ask how old you were when you finally received a copy?
Last year it was around 23.
You're 23 years old.
So
2+ decades of being denied opportunities and deprived of the rights that you deserve as a Malaysian. Okay, Melati, what category does Yu Lee kind of fall into? I mean, I understand there are many different quote-unquote categories of stateless populations here in Malaysia.
Yes.
Can you walk us through very quickly for Peninsular Malaysia, what are those categories?
Yeah, so I believe Yu Lee, and correct me if I'm wrong, so Yu Lee would fall under Category 4. There's so many categories. But, so Yu Lee would be basically a child born before a marriage was sort of legally registered. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
And so there can be a variety of reasons. So I'll just run through a couple different categories. There are people who, for example, have long-standing residence since pre-independence, so before Malaysia was a country. And those people and their descendants, so there are stateless groups like that where, for example, you would see in a house of 3 generations, none of them have ever left Malaysia, were born here, but are stateless. So that is one category.
Wow, so it's intergenerational.
Correct. The biggest change we've seen is three generations. So basically grandmother has kids and then kids are stateless and then they have kids and they're also stateless. So that's one group. We have abandoned children in Malaysia. Mm-hmm. So if you're abandoned and we cannot basically trace your connection to Malaysia, you are going to be stateless. We have adopted children in Malaysia. So we spoke to a number of parents, for example, who have adopted children, but cannot prove that their children have ties to Malaysia outside of their own ties. So this group, I think, has been reasonably successful in sort of trying to get reparations, in a sense, through the legal system. So parents generally have to take, you know, this case to court and stuff like that. So, of course, this excludes lower income families. But it seems like there is at least some success, I think, with that group. We have the category where, for whatever reason, marriage registration was incomplete or not done according to how the Malaysian government would sort of certify it. We have, for example, children born to children born abroad, I think the Family Frontiers case. So in that situation, in some cases, the kids cannot actually get access to the father's citizenship, in which case they're stateless. We spoke to some of those parents as well. And then I guess the two other main categories would be indigenous persons, so orang asli. There is a significant number actually who are still do not hold blue ICs, essentially. And then we also have stateless refugees. So Rohingya people would fall under this category.
Why was it important to make the distinctions between these categories? Is it different for, say, Peninsula and then East Malaysia?
Yes. So to be very clear, so this report only covers Peninsular Malaysia because I think the issues in Sabah and Sarawak are slightly different due to sort of the borders with Indonesia and stuff like that. So the reasons for statelessness are slightly different. So we sort of focus on Peninsular, and why we broke it into these categories was actually so that we could sort of cover like a breadth of statelessness rather than looking at one group.
Understood. Okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about the consequences of a person who is stateless in Malaysia. Your experience, Yuli, what were the, how did being stateless affect your ability to find stable employment, you know, make sure that you have a secure livelihood? How did you have trouble, I'm wondering, accessing education, healthcare services, all the basic necessities without proper documentation?
For employment, we look at the basic. You don't have citizenship means you don't have IC. You don't have IC, you cannot do banking stuff. You don't have bank account. So for what problem I faced throughout a few years back is that a company wants to hire you, but you don't have bank account, but they don't usually reimburse the salary in cash. So some of the company, they actually don't want to employ you just to keep these problems away. And another problem for stateless, but not on my case, because I can still manage to open up a KWSP account.
Okay.
So for many other stateless person out there, they cannot get KWSP account.
Right.
So they cannot work legally because you are not a Malaysian. You are not a foreigner. In Malaysia, you have IC. For foreigner, you have visa. There's no path for us to being accepted, being employed. That's the problem with the employment. And for education, I also consider myself lucky. I still can complete my bachelor degree in computer science. But for many other people out there, they face problems during primary education, primary school, secondary school, where you need to submit a registration based on you are a foreigner. We call it Warga Luar, Warga Asing, the channel for that. But for that, the problem is that you can apply, but you need to explain. You need to show proof that you are applying for citizenship. But for those that are not applying, they couldn't have this access at all for education. So for that, if the application is approved, you have to start the school late by 2 months, 3 months, which you miss a lot of learning at that period.
Yeah. But and it's not even just learning, it's also the fitting in, the making friends, that very important, you know, intangible aspect. Melati, is Yuli's case, he kept saying that he's lucky, but, you know, there are so many deprivations that a person who doesn't have the proper documentation has to go through, and it changes throughout the life cycle.
Correct.
From education to working. What have been some of the consequences that you found in the research for stateless people?
So I think one thing that was very striking to me is this problem typically happens right when you're a kid. So, you know, you are either born stateless or actually when you're 7 years old, which is what happens a lot in the report, your parents try to register you for school, and then the school says, no, you're not Malaysian, we cannot register you. And so I think that itself is sort of kind of a rejection of society, I feel, towards these kids, which has long-lasting impact. So I think mental health is a very big issue surrounding this group, especially with parents as well, trying to support the kids who are stateless. We have a lot of issues with employment, kids not being able to take exams, healthcare access is also impacted because, you know, I can go to a KKM hospital and pay one ringgit. Stateless people cannot.
Melati brought up the mental health aspect. What have been some of the emotional and psychological impacts to you living in a state of uncertainty? And also, you know, how that has impacted your relationships with other people, with the community?
For the people around me, they are quite supportive. They are quite curious. They are quite exciting to know my story. But in psychological aspect, I would say, in very short, simple words, you cannot have dream if you are a stateless person. At the age that we are pursuing dream, me, myself, I cannot pursue any dream. I have dreams to become what. I couldn't do that because I couldn't have any IC. I didn't have IC. I don't have citizenship. I cannot pursue. When I look at people who achieve their dream, I will sometimes say to myself, wow, I could be that. That could be me. Things could be better. But this is a state of uncertainty stateless person is living. Why? Because you have to put in application for citizenship. The processing time is very long. You have to wait. There's no defined waiting time for that process. So I've waited for around 6 years, 7 years, 6 years for two applications to get back the result, to get back any answers. But this uncertainty is that you don't know what to do next. What's next is the often question that came to my mind.
That is shocking. So 3 years, so after the application was submitted, 3 years of every day not knowing if that day was the day you would receive a response on your application. Is that typical, 3 years, Melati?
Very, very typical. Okay. In fact, I would say 3 years is probably minimum. Honestly. Yes. We spoke to people who've like 8, 10 years. And the thing is, I mean, imagine waking up every day not knowing what's going to happen, and you have to wait for this one letter that comes through mail. When it comes and says, like, ditolak, it doesn't give you any reason, so you have no idea how to fix your application, but you try again. Like, if you talk to people that, oh, it's okay, we try again. And so, I don't know, Yuli, how many times did it take you?
It took me 3 times. Yeah. First 2 times, I was ditolak, rejected without being given any reasons at all.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, how do I fix that? What do I do? What should I do next?
Yeah.
Is there a cutoff point, you know, when you turn 18 or 21? Is that, do you have to be a minor to apply for citizenship?
So there is a bit of differences in the paperwork. So I think one thing that I like to communicate is sort of the burden of paperwork into this whole process that really falls on children for the most part. So once you reach 18, I think you can no longer apply under certain...
21.
Yeah, you cannot... Yeah, so it sort of changes and the form changes. And so if the application... So, for example, you put it in when you're 16 and then you hit 18 and then somebody looks at it when you're 19, they'll just say, ditolak, it comes back to you, you have to just restart. So 18 is sort of a cutoff point, so everybody tries to get everything in by 18, but... I mean, if you're waiting, for example, 4 rounds of 3 years, that's 12 years.
Exactly. Yep. You won't have that many attempts or opportunities to apply.
And you don't have documents in the meantime. That's also the thing. I mean, you have a receipt that says you've applied.
Yes, it's the only receipt.
It's a receipt.
Okay. Yeah. You cannot do anything with a receipt. If you go to the bank, you tell them, I'm still applying for citizenship. It will tell you, wait until you get citizenship, get an IC, then we can do a bank account for you.
Yeah.
Right. So it's nothing. You don't have any... identification. So for the past few years, what identification I have student ID only.
Okay.
So for those like you are visiting something, they have strict security, they ask for your IC,
right.
They ask for a driving license, right. You cannot have it, you cannot enter that facility.
I mean, just coming into the Astra Studios,
you need
identification. Yes. So an undocumented person would not be able to participate.
They would show you their receipt.
Okay.
Probably.
You have to explain, you have to talk many from why you are stateless, like what are the processes that you make them understand. So that's the hardest process for a stateless person. Like many people ask me, why are you stateless? Why are you not Malaysian? So sometimes it's really very tiring to explain that to people. I'm Singaporean. that saves me a lot of time and effort.
It's emotional labor to have to educate someone about the issue of statelessness. Mm. You mentioned burden of paperwork, and I think that's really telling. how would one even know what the process is, the process and procedures to apply for citizenship, unless you, you know, are well-versed with the ins and outs of the National Registration Department?
Yep.
What was your process like? How did you know which forms to fill, and did someone guide you?
The officer in NRD is providing very minimal guideline. Like, this is a form you should do, then they never explain much of it, okay. So I have to fill in.
But see, so if I could add something as well, sometimes they actually, and I'm not sure why we explore this a bit in the report, but sometimes they actually tell you to fill in the wrong form. And so you don't actually know that you filled in the wrong
you
form.
Mean the way at the counter they've given the wrong form?
They'll tell you
form.
Fill in this form.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then you're supposed to fill in that form. But there's like five different forms, like A, B, C, D, E, I think.
So that sets you back. And then
it does.
Therefore your
and you
application
don't know.
Is rejected. Ditolak tanpa penjelasan, right?
Yes.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about that. How do we improve that process?
So these forms, actually, from the JPN's perspective, are actually sort of, you have to go and talk to them to get the forms. And so I think this whole process is really too complicated for families to maneuver. I think there's too much burden of paperwork on families to do this. Maybe you, Lee, can speak about some of this as well. But in some cases, for example, you have to take paternity tests to prove that your father is, in fact, this Malaysian man.
Which you have to pay for yourself.
Yeah, and you have to pay for DNA tests, which can be thousands of ringgit on top of every other expense that you're incurring. So one of the biggest suggestions, I think, from the report is for JPN to sort of streamline this process and actually tell people exactly why their application was denied, right? So if it was the wrong form, if it was this thing I didn't have, like, you should be telling the applicants, because it's so inefficient, like, looking at the allocation of how this is done. It's
okay. So clearly it's a very, you know, a difficult and complex process, but also not transparent, so opaque in terms of which forms and all that. Did you have anyone help you in terms of assistance from any government agencies, NGOs, I don't know, was there a caseworker that helped you
actually,
specifically?
What I did is that I have to explore myself, I have to go to the website, like what they want, what they feel, but ending up on my third application, I do have some help from certain NGO. They have some expert they can provide. How do you fill out the form? What should you do? What supporting document you should add?
Okay.
So this is some advice from them, but I think I gotten most of the help from my MP.
Yep.
He's a lawyer, so he has his lawyer helping me. So they've been like telling us what to do. Certain lawyers, they do know what to do,
right.
But at a price, at a cost.
So here's my concern with that, right? Although wonderful to hear that MPs are helping constituents with their issues, it also breeds a petitionary culture, a culture where you have to go to your MP to seek help, as opposed to systems already in place and strengthened institutions. What would you say are ways we can avoid this trap of having one person help you through back channels?
So that's something that I feel like a home ministry, and again, JPN really has to look at this whole process in particular, because I think if JPN does a slightly better job at explaining how is the process, for example, when you do a citizenship interview, what is involved in that? There's a proficiency test as well.
A citizenship interview. So that means you don't get your documentation just based on paperwork. You have an oral exam.
There's an interview.
They would like to know like what's your level on BM.
Yes.
They like want to hear you speak. They will ask you to a separate interview room before they accept your application.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the thing.
But you see, the thing is again, like, and like if you've gone through the process, you realize that nobody actually tells you, for example, what's going to be in the interview, what's going to be tested. Is there like a guidebook you can study from? There's nothing like that. So we've met and studied sort of case law where people have basically not been able to get citizenship because they failed their BM proficiency tests.
Okay. And that, you know, is also, I mean, where would they have avenues to get help on that? So many people might not have avenues for that. Very quickly, can I ask you, other countries, do they also view the issue of the processes and procedures of citizenship with the same type of rigor and almost national security lens the way we look at it?
So I think a lot of other countries actually have signed, I think, a couple more sort of international law conventions that make them beholden to certain conduct when it comes to stateless populations. But I do feel that one thing that is striking when we did sort of a cross-country comparison was how rigid it was with regards to children. So kids, for example, here still have to go through this whole process that Yuli went through, still have to not be able to access school and all of this stuff. And I think there's a very strong argument, for example, that if you're a foundling, one of the categories of stateless people we found here, where you know somebody found you in Malaysia with no guardians or parents, but you were clearly born here because you're 2 days old, I think there is sort of, in other countries, there's sort of some regulations that basically say, okay, you are somebody who are basically a citizen, right? Because where else would you be coming from if you were found as a baby? And the other way around as well. So we have, for example, a lot of Malaysians who are senior citizens who, for whatever reason, are still waiting for citizenship, and they're in their 70s, 80s, still have a red IC, which is only a permanent resident. So there's also an argument that if you're very old and you've spent your whole time here, that perhaps, you know, you should be granted citizenship. And that's what some countries do as well.
Okay. All right. So maybe reduce statelessness in certain categories,
yes,
of populations. Based on your report, the very hefty 300...
Yes, sorry.
I mean, it was well-researched. What were some of the other policy recommendations? We talked a little bit about how we... the need to improve the procedures, the processes. Mm. What other recommendations did you find?
I think the other biggest recommendation for me, for kids specifically, is schooling. So I think schooling should really, like public schooling in Malaysia should not be limited to basically people who only with ICs. I think when Mazli was the education minister, there was sort of this push on a high level, Putrajaya level, to let stateless people and even refugee kids into public schools. But the issue that we found was that sort of lower level administration would get in the way. So the school would say, for example, like, oh, you're stateless, we can't actually let you in, or the district office or the educational office or the state educational department would say, no, that's not a policy that we actually do, and so you can't enter school. So there's really no coordination, I would say, for schooling, and that's something that I would really like to see, is kids being able to go to school. Because kids, I think, and I brought this up to Yuli before, kids grow up to become adults,
yes,
right?
Eventually become grown up.
Yes, and people who work and contribute to Malaysia, so it makes absolutely no sense that they are denied education.
What about you? Is there anything that you would like to see change, policy reforms, mm-hmm, changes that you think is necessary to address some of the challenges that...
I think the first step is very vital, which is we need to acknowledge. I believe that when Dr. Melati do the research, what is the population number of statelessness? We don't have that, right?
No.
We don't have official data. But back then, when we did the recent Banji, the census, there is a selection for stateless category. I think we need to release that population data. Then we can acknowledge the problem. Then we know there is a stateless population.
True.
In Malaysia. Then by then, we can do maybe policy maker. They can do some national level or policy level things. But when meantime they are doing that policy level thing, we need a short-term solution for grown out, for the adult like us, because children eventually become grown out. We need to be employed, we need to study, we need to have access to healthcare. That's the important thing. So meanwhile, they are doing policy level, which is they are doing now, I believe. So I think that we need a short-term solution for a stateless person.
Well, it's remarkable that there is no data released, at least, as to how big these populations are. And without knowing that, you really don't know the scale of how big the impact is, right? I do want to ask you, is this an issue that ordinary Malaysians, people can, you know, the public can speak up about, can contribute to? Is there any way for us to help address the issue of statelessness? It's such a long-standing issue and one that many people have tried to tackle. So it sometimes feels to us like, oh, I can't do anything about it.
So one thing that I've been advocating, and the reason why I'm on the show, I think, is just try to get the word out to how ridiculous this problem is, actually. Like, before I even studied this, somebody was telling me when I began, one of the lawyers is like, you will find that it all boils down to which form. And I was like, there's no way this problem is about forms. But it's about forms. Like, it's about other things, but it's also about forms. And so I feel like with more sort of education to the public and just knowing about this problem and, you know, thinking about basically people who are, you would not be able to distinguish them from anybody else, but in fact are living very, very different lives.
Yuli, your last minutes that we have here, what would you like to let the public know about this issue?
For public, maybe what I wanted to say is that to everyone maybe who is watching this, maybe we can talk more, know more about statelessness, because someone maybe puts like attention to people around you. They could be look like Malaysian, they speak like Malaysian, they live a Malaysian life, they could be stateless. So to those people out there, please maybe put more attention on that, then maybe can give some support to them. By any means you can,
So can I ask you, before you received your documentation, and even now, as you say that you feel like it hasn't yet been resolved, right? What could have the people around you done better to have helped you through your challenges? What can we do to others who are facing the same situation?
I think what the simplest thing they can do is that they must understand the issue of statelessness. Okay. Because most of people out there, they don't know what is statelessness.
So they ask you and then you have to explain it to them.
I have to explain every time, very tiring.
It's very
exhausting. Sometimes they do have like misunderstanding is that stateless is actually foreigners.
Yeah. So there's stigma?
There's a stigma, okay. Yes. There's a stigma, so we need to change that.
Well, I want to thank you both for raising this issue, allowing me to ask you questions, sharing your experiences, your insights, your research on all of this. I appreciate your time. That's all we have for you on this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching, and good night.